So I'm Kevin Hartman. I run an analytics team for an advertising agency. And I really believe that I've got probably the best job there is. I mean, my charter is basically to go find stories and data and then figure out how those things help us make better advertising. It's a lot of fun, but the best thing about it is that the client expectations of a guy with longish hair working for an advertising agency, like showing them anything about numbers, are really, really low. So I swear to God, I could hand draw like an addition equation and they would pat me on the head and pin it to the company refrigerator. So I'm constantly surprising and delighting them too, because I'm doing things like multiplication and other really tricky things. But first off, before we get going, just a couple rules sort of for the session. So turn your phones on. I think we get told so often in meetings and other things to turn them off. We want them on in this. We want you tweeting as much as you can. That's my Twitter handle there. And then the hashtag for the session is South by Southwest Riots. So go ahead. Let me know what you like, what you don't like, questions you have. I'll get back to everybody with any kind of questions that they have. As well, we've got probably an hour's of worth of content that I'll try to skinny down a little bit and save some room for Q&A. But if we don't get to that, I'll get to anything that you all send through Twitter. So here's what when I started researching this and just looking at the dynamics of social media and what had happened in the London riots, it reminded me of a story I had heard a long time ago. I'm going to tell it. This is the second time I've told it, so forgive me if I kind of flub, but I thought it was right on. A long time ago, one of the legends, a pioneering legend in the blues sounds in the Deep South, passed away. And his family, in preparing the funeral services, reached out to a young and really up-and-coming and dynamic blues musician in the Chicago area. And they asked him if he would do them the honor of coming down and playing tribute at the burial. And so he was, of course, overwhelmed, and he hopped in his car, packed up his trumpet, and headed down to Mobile. Now, there was no, at this time, there's no GPS or anything, long time ago, right? So he gets hopelessly lost around Kentucky, and then winds up finding his way, speeding through the night, and arriving at the cemetery 4 hours late, right? So he's driving around and looking for the funeral party, which is, of course, gone. And as he's driving around, he comes upon these three men who are digging. And so he slams on the brakes, hops out of his car, grabs his trumpet, runs over to this large hole in the ground, which has this dome-shaped thing below it that, you know, he takes to be representative of the glory and kind of the stature of the man that he was there to honor. And so he just very reverently opened up his trumpet case and began to play. And he played like he's never played before. He played Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. He played There's a Balm in Gilead. And then he played a version of Amazing Grace that would make angels cry. And as the last notes were still kind of drifting through the air, he just very quietly and reverently closed up his case and turned and walked back to his car. And as he got to his car and reached for his latch, he overheard one of the workers say to the other, "Man, I have never heard or seen anything like that before. And I've been installing septic tanks for 20 years." Right? Perceptions matter. Right? That's a theme that you'll hear throughout this whole talk. Perceptions matter. The perceptions that you have of what you're reading on social networking and in social media matters. It dictates how you will behave. The way that people perceive what you're saying dictates how you perceive, how they behave. And here's the thing. The social media and the dynamic that it's created is this situation where everything is in a context vacuum. There is no context whatsoever to the tweets, to the wall posts, to things that you're seeing. You don't know the person that are posting those things. You don't know their upbringing, right? You don't know their sense of humor, nor do they know yours necessarily. And so what you're left with are words on a screen. And those words on a screen are up for you to interpret, to dictate, and then perceive and allow yourself then to act, right? So what the outcome of that is that there's no time, never been a time where it's more important to know who it is you're speaking with or who you are speaking to in social media. And that's really the story of what the London riots taught us about social media is really, that's one of the themes. It's really a story of the power of social media. It's the power that can be used for good or for bad, but the kind of behaviors and the elements of those behaviors that need to be in place for people to act on them. Now, when I was putting this thing together, it would have been very, very easy to just pull a bunch of YouTube videos and pictures, and frankly, it would have been pretty interesting to look at that electronic record of what the riots really were. Gruesome, terrifying video of a young university student being mugged very slowly and deliberately, right, on camera. Pictures of another man being forced to strip by a mugger who's looking for cash, right? All the windows kicked in, everything smashed. I mean, tremendously evocative photos and media created through this experience. But for me, what's really important is getting behind that and getting behind the behaviors and the things that need to be in place for someone to actually act. And so that's what we do. We'll do it today a little bit. It will be somewhat heavy on theory, some of that theory substantiated, some of it completely a gut guess on my part. But what I hope to do is at least put together for you the ability to kind of identify and then influence behaviors through social media. Now, whether you do that for good or bad is up to you. I won't be responsible for that. But at least we can talk a little bit about the things that are needed and to be put in place so that you can do that. Now, one just quick disclaimer. I'm not a sociologist. I'm a data guy who loves numbers and loves data and loves to pull out the stories. I'm not a Londoner. I've lived there, and just by coincidence, my family was in the UK and in London in the weeks before the riots. But I don't claim to know exactly that political situation. I don't claim to know exactly what's going on there. What I do know, though, are the data that I've analyzed and the things that I've seen in that data and the story that it tells. So where to begin? I think where this whole thing begins is really here. The fact that this really feels familiar. 26 years ago, in an area of London called Tottenham, there was something called the Broadwater Farm Riot, and it began under very similar circumstances. Cynthia Jarrett was a mother whose son was accused of theft. Police came to her house. There was a scuffle at the house. Cynthia had a stroke and fell down dead. People in the area who had already had enough of police treatment of blacks in the area organized a very peaceful march, a very peaceful demonstration that started in the streets of Tottenham and wound up at a police station. And as they got to the police station, something went left and it erupted into violence. That spread through the area, and for a few nights there were raging riots in London. 26 years later, much the same thing happens when Mark Duggan is shot. A march is organized through the streets of Tottenham that wind up at a police station. Something again turns to the left. There's violence, and what happens next, though, is what really is extraordinary, what the story is. If you look at the difference between that experience 26 years ago and the experience this past summer in just arrests, 69 arrests, less than 100 arrests 26 years ago, close to 4,000 arrests with the in this past summer related to that riot. Less than a 1 million pounds of damage and property done 26 years ago. Well over now, 100 million is the estimate in damage to property done this summer as a result of the riots. And then for me, even most telling, the areas that were affected, one single area, Tottenham 26 years ago was really the only area that was affected by the Broadwater Farms riots. 38 boroughs of London or cities in the UK affected this past summer. Now, to say it was social media would be a very easy and somewhat lazy, I think, assessment. But when you analyze this and you look at it, there really substantially was nothing different from that experience 26 years ago to the experience this past summer but social media. And when you look at some of the things that really drove the spreading of the violence and the spreading of the really gathering weight behind the rioting, social media was right at the middle of it. But now to understand that, this is where we'll take just a quick step into some theory and look at what really activates behavior. Why do people behave the way they do? Why do we behave the way we do, right? Why do we file our tax returns, right? Why do we fall in love? Why do we do anything that we do? Here's a really simple framework that that I think explains a lot of that, or at least it does for me. And it's been at the center of the social justice system for a long time, so it's tried quite a bit. It's a simple model of motive, opportunity, and means, where means is the resources available to act, right? Either the mental, the physical, or some sort of resources I have that will allow me to make a decision. Opportunity means I'm in that spot where I can choose. I can either act or I can't act. And then motive is the ability to rationalize the actions that I've done. If I have all those three things, I have the potential to act. Doesn't mean I will act, but if I don't have one of those three things, there's no way that I'm partaking in some kind of behavior. What is missing from this chart in here now is a spark. The spark is that emotional response that really triggers us from just being someone with motive, means, and opportunity to someone who is taking on a behavior and acting. And the spark takes on a number of forms. A real spark, an imagined spark, what I've called a fabricated spark, and a usurped spark. A real spark, like I was saying, every year we start to gather our tax returns, and by April 14th, hopefully most of us will file some kind of return. So those returns are made readily available. You have the means. No matter how busy you are, right, you can find some time to fill out that tax return. That's the opportunity. The motive could be a number of things. It could be just the wanting to avoid a penalty for a late return. It could be a big windfall that you're expecting back, right, in refund. But whenever you have that, you won't act until something sparks it. And maybe that is that emotion that, wow, I hope I could buy something with the money that I'm going to get, or the fear of being levied a tax or a penalty on top of that. That's what will push you into action. That's a real, genuine spark, something that is what it is, what it looks like on the surface. Imagined, an example of that, a few weeks ago in Philadelphia, three men walking down the street one way, one man walking the other way. The one man across the street starts to make gestures wildly and yell. The three men cross the street, confront him, and wind up beating him to death. It turns out that the one man was simply trying to hail a cab. Right? That's where the three men across the street had imagined that this man was provoking them, when it was completely was not the case at all. That's in that case an imagined spark. Fabricated. Doesn't always have to be nefarious. Like any time that you've kind of tricked someone into going into a conference room for a surprise birthday party, right, you've established that fabricated spark. And then usurped is probably the most common, and yet really, particularly in this case, I think the most important one. And we'll see later on when I talk about some of the sparks that really drove a lot of the activity in London, how a lot of those were usurped. They were taking advantage of an obvious spark on the surface to really promote their own means and promote their own ends. Now, when we talk about these sparks, one other little bit of theory. There's really, all humans share a basic set of emotions. There's six of them. Anything that you feel, anything that you're talking about can really be pulled back to these six. And there are hundreds of models like this, but this is the one that I like. Those six are because I like simple things, and this is the simplest. This is the only one that I found with six. Those things are fear and hope. Right, kind of balancing each other as a positive and a negative emotion, anger and love, sorrow and joy. Fear and hope, incidentally, are those two emotions that we find to be most strong at compelling people into action. Right, anger and love can make people act as well. It's usually out of passion, and it's usually not sustained. It's a quick kind of action. And then sorrow and joy are really, when we look at this emotionally, those are more emotional byproducts, almost, you could say. They're not emotions that are out there in the forefront kind of pushing people to act, but they're feelings that people are expressing after something has happened. Now, here's where social media comes in, because what social media and the networks that have been created really does is they become tremendous conduits for that emotion, like we've never seen before. I mean, you think about yourself just sending out a tweet with some kind of emotion attached to it. You know, maybe I love this soda, or this meal is fantastic, or man, these lines suck. Whatever you're saying and you're pushing out to people that you know, the people in your social network, you'd expect some part of them to resonate, that message to resonate with them. And then as they begin to push that out, that's where it starts to grow. And if they get outside of your network, it grows even further. This is 1,000. And then very quickly, if those people push out their responses to a Facebook wall or a retweet, it moves very quickly to 4,000, We get up to 20, close to 20,000, right? And then this is what a million people look like. Now, that person up in the top left will probably never meet that person down in the bottom right, right? No chance. They'll never know each other. They'll never really have much of a context for who they are, what they do. And yet we've got this thing in place through social networks and the things that have been developed to really push emotion from that person all the way up in one corner, all the way down to the millionth person in the other corner. This whole thing kind of combines, here's the end of theory, whole thing kind of combines in this what I kind of call Blaze theory, where you've got the opportunity, the motive, and the means in place. There's some kind of spark that's driven by emotion. And then just like a forest fire, right, it kind of sets out. And this, in advertising, this sort of contradicts a long-held model of getting celebrity endorsements, right, and trying to get what would effectively be, in this metaphor, like the tallest tree, right? And you're not, if you look at the way a forest fire spreads, it doesn't spread because the tallest tree catches fire. It's the one that has the most integrated lattice of branches, yeah? So that's what you're looking for. Those people who have all those connections, those are the people who start to spread the fire. Those are the people who start to spread emotion from one place to another, and that's how you get big reactions. So then using that kind of model and looking at the London riots, how were those things achieved? And we'll start and look a little bit at means. And the story of means really does kind of begin, and it almost could end with this, right? I mean, all of us have this. Mobile phone, particularly smartphone penetration in the UK is even greater than it is in America. That thing that we all hold in our hands is a million times cheaper, 1,000 times stronger, and 100 times smaller than the sole computer that was in MIT in 1969. 1969 is an important date, too, so I'll talk about that a little later. But that kind of power, connective power that we all walk around with, is really the beginning of the means for this event happening in London. And this has contributed directly to the explosive growth of Facebook, the explosive growth of Twitter. I mean, what you're really left with is a globally networked community. Close to 600 million people who are active social networkers, right? In the developed countries, it's more than half of all adults, 52% of adults. It's 134 active social networkers in Britain and the U.S. alone. And the funny thing, if you step back and take a little context on that, is we're pretty middle of the road. I mean, 52% is the global average for adults being active social networkers. And the U.S. and the U.K. fall right around that mean. We're a long ways to go before we're in, like, the Philippines range or some of the Eastern European, or even some of the Eastern European countries like Russia or Poland, before we have really strong penetration of heavy, heavy users of social media. But there's no reason to think that we won't get there. And one of the things that I believe kind of leads to the development of your social network is you could think of it as near-real collisions. It's people that you kind of run in circles with. You don't have to meet them personally, but your social networks collide together such that they suddenly start following you, you start following them because you share the same interests, you've been to the same places, you know the same people. And one big contributor to that is urbanization. And if you look at the growth or projected growth of urbanization, in the U.S. right now we're at about 300 million people, right, in urban places. You look at India and China alone over the next 30 years are expected to add more people in their urban centers than the U.S. has in its urban population now. So effectively what took us, 250 years to create, India and China are going to do in the next 30 years, build 300 million people or more into their urban infrastructure. Those many people kind of circulating, doing the same things, hitting the same cafes, meeting the same people, the number of people in those social networks are just going to continue to grow and grow. And it's happening very quickly. One other illustration of that is just looking at data and what's happened with data and all the data that we're throwing off. All this, the big data as has been a big topic of conversation this year here at South by Southwest. You go all the way back to the first computer introduced and you look at the amount of data that was created and is in storage. Well, 90% of that has been built in the last 2 years. So we're just getting going, too, right? This is, incidentally, this is exactly why big data has become such a big thing. People talking about this for decades now, what you could do with all this data and all the correlations you could run and all the insights that you could gain. Now that we've reached in the last 2 years sort of this critical mass of data being accumulated, that's why it's become such a big thing. And this is really, of all that means talk, like this is really the upshot. If you think about the number of people that you meet and have conversation with in the day, I looked for studies of this all over the place, and I found a wild range. And it ranged from 10 people, the average person speaks with 10 people during a day, from their spouse to a barista, right, up to 30. So let's say that you're on that higher scale. Let's say that you're having some kind of conversation with 30 people each day. You're emitting emotion, and you're sharing some kind of conversation. Or maybe you're super social, and it's 50, or maybe even super, super social, right, and you're talking to 100 different people every day. In the UK right now, the average person has over 500 people in their social network. So that's where these mobile phones with the connectivity that they have and the kind of weight and the power that they have behind them in the network, that's all the means they needed really to instigate and to kick off the events that we saw this summer. Now, talking about opportunity, we'll talk about this from a couple angles, but one of the things that I wanted to look at was just the policing force in the UK. Right now, for every 324 citizens, there's one police officer, right? And that's not out of line with the other European countries. Really, truthfully, it's not out of line with the U.S. either. So the U.K. had a police force. It wasn't a police state, but it's not like they had a lax policing force there. And an experienced one as well. I mean, there were 10.6 violent or property crimes last year for every police officer in the U.K., so this is a force that wasn't taken by surprise either. I mean, they're used to dealing with violent and property crime. And again, this number is really not outside what you'd see in other European countries. So they're not inexperienced. But to really, I think what, for me, of all the things that I looked at, what really best articulated the opportunity here was a journal that was written anonymously by a man that supposedly partook in the riots and then publish these things anonymously. I'll just read this for you in case you can't see the screen, but this is him talking about his experience with the riots. I pull out my BlackBerry and check for the blinking light on top corner. Nothing yet. So I type in a single word, Hackney, and send it to all my contacts. I only have to wait 2 or 3 seconds before I get responses. Sounds good, I say. I wasn't involved in the Saturday night. I had nothing to do with the protest about the shooting on Ferry Lane. That's the shooting of Mark Duggan. It wasn't until the Sunday that I tagged along. Once the word had spread that it was moving on to Wood Green, just around the corner from me on Muswell Hill, once folk told me that the police weren't stopping us, we's one step ahead of the feds, bruv, and that I best get involved before all the best bargains went. That's opportunity. Police aren't there to stop us. Other people are doing it. It's right around the corner from me. They're there. They can make those decisions. That's how the riots moved even further. The next thing is motive. And to look at this, there's a generational story here, I think, that needs to be told. And to look at the generations in the UK and label them the same way we label them, right? The boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z. There's a lot of difference between these generations. Even if you look at two of them that are supposedly very similar, if you look at Gen X and Gen Y, right, they're in major, major categories and major behaviors, they are acting very differently from one another and having very different experiences. And really, all that separates them is maybe a decade. Gen X is the most educated generation in history, my generation. The next generation, Gen Y, will be the most educated in history. In terms of career, I love this, but Gen X are victims of the ass ceiling created by boomers, right? It's boomers who thought they would be out of the workforce by now, but because of the crashes and other things, they've been forced to stay in their jobs and just limiting the opportunities for Gen X. Gen Y just can't find jobs, right? Gen X is entering the most expensive life stage. Gen Y, still instant gratification is a way of life. Gen X is enduring the second recession of the professional career. Gen Y thinks of spend on tech as a need, not a want. Gen X is lost most of its savings. Gen Y really has high levels of discretionary spending right now, not a need for a lot of savings. Gen X carrying a lot of debt. Gen Y not as much. Right? These are two very different experiences and outlooks and interpretations from people who really are not that different. So when you juxtapose that, or you put that then inside the other generations, which are even further out, you get this dynamic that I call the War of the Ages. And really what it is there's an inherent distrust of age, right? The older, the more mature generations don't trust the younger ones. They look at them as disruptive. The younger ones don't trust the structures that the mature generations have put in place. There's this incredible power inequality. And it kind of goes two ways. The more mature generations have all these structures and systems that have been put in place, where the younger generations have things like the internet and technology and things that are really powering the economies and powering progress. And the result of that is really the disenfranchisement of youth. The more mature generations will use those structures and put those things in place to prevent the younger generations from mobilizing, from succeeding. So to look at Britain in that sort of context and figure out if there's a war of an ages going on, the answer is pretty clear. This is by penetration here, this just means awareness. So awareness of social networking is obviously very, very high in the UK, 100% awareness of Facebook last year, and very, very high awareness of others. But if you look at who's using it, it is a young person's tool, right? Not unlike what we have here in the US, this is the percent of people at each age range that are active users of social media. Very high with the younger consumers and younger people. And then as you go through those generations, it starts to tail off. There's also income inequality. This is a distribution of income in Britain, that mean is right around less than 500 pounds per week. To put that in context, if you look at the average house price in Britain, right, that's about £300 per week. Now, so a government recommendation or government definition of an affordable house is like 30% of income, which would mean that for someone in Britain to afford even an average house, you know, they'd have to be making close to £800 a week. Which means if you're there, all of your income would have to go to buy you a place in the nice part of Britain, right, in Kensington or in Chelsea. What this really does is it creates tremendous inequality, but also relative poverty, not absolute poverty. You know, even the people who are at the mean or even a bit below the mean in the UK are far better off than people in sub-Saharan Africa and other places in the world for sure. They don't suffer absolute poverty. But when you can't afford a fucking house, right, in the neighborhood that you grew up in, right, that your parents grew up in, and you look at people who you have no dream of ever owning a home in Kensington or Chelsea, right, and those people are living amongst you and they're being marketed to just as you are and bombarded with the same sort of advertising and the same sort of consumerist messages, that is relative poverty. Right, that is relative poverty, and that is what the people there in the UK is very much a part of their existence in their everyday. Now, just to further that point of income inequality, if you look at the amount of income that went to the top 1% of the UK population, it reached its peak back in the 30s prior to now at around 13%. And then years and years and years of social policy and other things that were in place kind of lowered that figure until it reached a low point in 1976 of 4.2%. 4.2% of total national income going to the top 1% of earners. And then very quickly, the 80s came and the whole thing unraveled, right? And went right away very quickly and to the point that we're now even above that high water mark in 1937. Now it's close to 14% of the nation's income goes to that top 1% of earners. Again, just furthering that point of relative poverty being felt in the UK. Other things, if you start to look at the generational dynamic and you start to introduce social psychographic kind of data as well, the picture is even becomes even more clear. This is tech... early adopters, index against the general population. And so you see as you go from boomers all the way down to Gen X, Y, and then Z, it takes off, right? It starts to lift up. The same is true of the idea that I buy my technology to impress. It's something that I use to impress people. Again, that kind of, it starts to tilt up. Facebook usage, certainly Twitter usage, right, doing the same thing. The younger generations are feeling these things much stronger and much more involved in these than the older generations. Conversely, you look at something like equal opportunity. You know, the simple question of, do I as a person have equal opportunity to the people around me? Boomers say yes, right? And then it starts to trail off as you go back out to the younger generations. Do I have social responsibility? Am I responsible to the society around me? Boomers say yes. As you start to go out, that starts to trail off. And then I think the biggest sign is if you ask them, am I content with my current position? Boomers say, oh, yeah, right? And then as you move out and you get down to Gen Y and Gen Z, it's less and less and less. That, I think, is the biggest indication of that motivation. I'm not content with the things around me. I'm not content with how I live. And here, we're going to visit our buddy again, the rioter, because I think his words do this better than anything I've seen to really articulate that opportunity. So here's he again. Understand, I am not unemployed. I'm not someone who'd mug you or knock you off your bike so that I could take it for myself. But if there were folk going around taking what they wanted, if they're coming away with flat-screen TVs and surround sound speakers from Richer Sounds, if they've got time to sit in a footlocker and try on trainers to make sure they're the right size, then I'm getting involved with that. I've been to university. I've been educated. I've got a job. That's true, but it's in a call center working on the telephone banking system. I am not a banker. I couldn't afford half the stuff I've taken over the past two nights. I'm just the poor fucker on the end of the line, end of the phone, who gets calls from the rich folk. I pay my rent, council tax, bills, and what do I have left? I have debt. That's what. That's motivation, right? That's the stuff. That's the psychology behind the motivation for these riots. They've got the means now. They've got the opportunities. The things are happening right around them. And now they've got clearly, I think, really well-articulated opportunity right here. So the last piece is just a spark, and that's where it somewhat becomes easy. There were a lot of things going on in London in the lead-up to those riots. There was kettling where police during demonstrations would surround demonstrators, and they would form these impenetrable lines where the demonstrators couldn't get out. Right, and so they would stand there all day, and they would have to go to the bathroom, or they would have to get a drink of water, or they'd have to get some food. And they couldn't get out until the police officer finally let them out to go do that, and as soon as they did, they were arrested, and they weren't, obviously, then allowed back in. That was the method that the UK was taking on to quell those protesters and quell the demonstrations. There was student services and student loans being cut that were demonstrated against widely in the UK. Youth centers were being closed. These were the only places that people, many people had to go after schools to stay off the streets. And because of some cuts in funding, those youth centers were being closed down. The News of the World, right, phone tap went on. Like, if you already weren't suspicious of your government, then this is happening now. And so this is just feeding that fire and feeding that frenzy. And then finally, and there's some pretty, it's not necessarily even graphic, but pretty telling, I think, YouTube footage of Ian Tomlinson, who was a man that was a newspaper vendor, simply walking home on his way at the end of the day and passed through a demonstration, got too close to a police officer who caught him out of the corner of his eye and batoned him, and Ian fell over, hit his head, walked about a half block later, and then fell over dead. So then that happens, right? And so now there's a man killed at the hands of police. And that's when things are really starting to reach a fevered pitch. And then to look at that in the context of what's going on in the world around them. I mean, while, you know, kettling is going on, the Arab Spring and the Arab riots are kicking off very clearly. And then as student protests are going, those Arab Spring riots are really storming through the Middle East. As the youth centers are being closed, the global financial crisis is reaching a high. As the scope of the phone hacking scandal is released, Spain is holding what they call the M15 protests in major cities to mark May 15th date, where literally hundreds of thousands of people were gathering. All of this is going on. Ian Tomlinson happens. And then Mark Duggan is shot. Right, Mark Duggan is shot. The Justice Walk is organized a couple of days later. Very quickly, rioting happens. It starts to spread throughout other parts of England. By the end of the week, you've got 1,000 people arrested. And as we said, that number is going to grow to about 4,000 over the next few days from there. Now, the really shocking thing, the thing that, again, from the very beginning, makes this so different from the Broadwater Farms experience is just how quickly this spread and how it spread from places inside Europe, different boroughs outside of Tottenham, to other cities in the UK. Now, it reached Manchester, right? I mean, Manchester's, if you've been, Manchester's a long ways away from England. I don't think there were too many people in Manchester who knew Mark Duggan personally, who at least knew him enough that they would be so angered by his death that they would go and storm a bookstore or smash a pub. Yeah, there's something else going on here. There's some other way that people are being instigated and people are flowing something to trigger people into action in these different places outside of London. And as we've been saying, like, that thing, when you start to look at it, is social media. This is just a look at the number of tweet impressions, so the number of eyeballs placed on tweets related to the riots. It's not just total. This is just related to the riots in the week, the week right around where the highest riot activity was going on. You got a country of about 50, 60 million people, 713 million tweet impressions, right? More than 10, close to 12, 15 per person in the UK. And those are just tweets, right? You've got news tweets and news organizations feeding this stuff in as well. And then we don't know how many BlackBerry messaging service messages there were, because it's all cloaked. It's impossible to track. But we do know from some other sources that was a real big source of communication between rioters. The U.S. was experiencing something very similar as well. I mean, for a country removed by an ocean, there were a lot of activity over here as well related to the riots and people tweeting and the news services picking those things, same things up and releasing those. And what were they tweeting, right? Now, there was all sorts of stuff tweeted, but as I said, a lot of this stuff was very emotional and could trigger someone into action. It just, again, it's their perception. It depends on what you are saying or thinking from these words on a screen. And these are just some of the more kind of inflammatory examples of people placing blame for the riots. So it's the blacks, right? So if you're someone in Manchester, right, and you hold this opinion and you get this tweet, like, that might be enough to send you into action, right? If that one doesn't work, how about this one? It's the blacks who are now causing this to happen among the whites, right? And if that doesn't get you, if you're not into race, well, how about the rich and the privileged government, right? Maybe you hate your government. Is that enough to get you to act, right? Or maybe it's the parents of those kids. Like, they're the ones to blame. It's a family issue. Or it's a pampered welfare state. It's the poor, right? They're the ones who are to blame. Or maybe it's even just the facts, right? Police shot dead a father of four in Tottenham and then lied about it. Like, maybe that's enough to push you into action. But whatever it is, this is literally a case of pick your poison. Whatever you wanted. There's someone out there tweeting, putting something out into that cyberspace, into those social networks, dropping those emotional tones to other people, and then they're spreading very quickly. And even things like this. Now, this is about as extreme as it gets. This is from the English Defense League, which, if any of you are familiar, it's probably about the closest thing that we've got to, or they've got to, a KKK, right? So what they're talking about is, hey, you know, police aren't really doing anything here. Let's go burn the mosques, right? So all this filth. But also, this stuff that's not only attracting people who feel this way, but also instigating and frustrating and angering people who don't, right? And so think about the emotional buildup and all the power that's going on over there as a result of this kind of conversation, and think about how that happens because of social media. So really quickly, just some of the things, some of the aftermath. This is what, when it was all sort of sorted and we looked at what had really happened, a lot of arrests for burglary, not as many for violent disorder. In fact, if you look at the people who were arrested, and there was this idea that it was really a dangerous kind of criminal element that had really gone out there and instigated all of this. But if you look at the 12 months prior to the riots, the average person who was arrested had 18 priors, right? In those riots, the average person arrested had 11. So it wasn't like these are hardened criminals walking around, thugging, and you do see a lot of that if you've seen any of the YouTube video and you've seen any of the video that comes out of that experience. But that wasn't necessarily the push behind a lot of the action. And even those people who were arrested, of those 11 kind of priors that they had, many of them, the 40%, 2 out of 5 of those were summary offenses, which I'm not making light of any crime, but this is truancy or this is loitering or these are things that aren't, it's not sticking a knife in someone, right? It's not the activity of hardened thugs. And it really becomes clear when you look at the age of people. This is just a sample of the arrests, of about half the arrests, but the vast majority, or relative to the other ages, were that 24 to 18 age group, right? And so if we put this again in the context of kind of the generational story that we were telling, it looks like this. It's 52% of people arrested were between the ages of 18 and 24, right? This was that younger generation. This was those people who are feeling this disenfranchisement. These are the people who are armed with mobile phones and enormous contacts, who have these things happening right around the corner for them, who don't feel like they have a proper place in the world, who don't feel like the things that they're being marketed to, that are marketing to them, they can afford. Those are the people who are behind the actions here. And it goes even further, the story. If you look at the places that were hit in the riots, 1/3 of them, that's a famous building on the left there in Tottenham, an old carpet factory that was converted to a residential area on their high street, that was set afire. But most of the places that were hit were retail locations. And when you look at the kind of retail locations, they were really just smash and grab and get something into my pockets. 12% of them, these electronics stores, 10% clothing, another 10% were restaurants. You had the independent tobaccoists and other shops that were smashed, supermarkets as well. They weren't indiscriminately, busting up furniture stores. Yeah. I mean, there were things that this was purposeful and directive, the actions that were going on. And so, again, in kind of this whole emotional kind of context, if we look at the things that really happened here, it's pretty clear that their opportunity was the result of widespread rioting and low levels of resistance. That's pretty clear. The means were these well-coordinated and concealed comms, communications between groups. And then the motive really was this disenfranchisement of youth. And that spark, Mark Duggan was certainly, the shooting of Mark Duggan was certainly the spark that people used. But as we discussed all the different ways those things can be used, I think it was pretty clear that incident was usurped for a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes motivations and other things that led to a lot of the rioting. So what did you all come here for? What did we learn about social media, right? So now just some quick lessons that kind of came out of that whole experience. One is that social networking follows the most effective path. Another is that it's a great tool to pool and democratize reaction to events. Information flows eliminate geographic divides. Emotional expressions belong to that beholder and that person that's perceiving the message. And then social media can be used for good too, right? Here's kind of some examples, and let me just go into that a little bit. These are examples of those BBM messages that I told you about that were being sent. And here's one: everyone from all sides of London, meet up in the heart of London, Oxford Circus, bear shops, we're going to get smashed up, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? This was a communication system that was used to effectively plan and coordinate those riot activities because they couldn't be tracked. They had learned from the experiences of the Arab Spring before that if you did this stuff over Twitter or other ways to organize that were open to the public, the police would be right there waiting for you. But if you use BBM, which was hidden cloaked communication, the police couldn't track it, right? So they could, you could be one step ahead of them. But also, if you look at just the mobile phone profile of the people in London, and you look at those major brands, 40%, so two out of every five UK youth own a BlackBerry. I mean, it's the phone of choice. So they already had that. It was there. And just as, you know, I'm saying how social media will follow the most efficient path, they've got the phone, it's a concealed communication, that's all you need, away it goes. Pooling and democratizing reaction. Now, this is particularly, what does this particularly well is Facebook. And if you look at the Facebook pages that were created as a result of the riots, it really does represent the way that people feel or felt about those events. Planking in the London riot, right? Here's one page on that. Here's another one. The legend who was planking during the Manchester riots, planking again in the London riots. Other pages devoted to making fun of rioters and sort of belittling them as morons and whatnot. Other pages about calling for a stop and end to the riots, cleanup activities as well, even some, you know, Mark Duggan, rest in peace. So now what we're able to do then is to go back in and just look at how many people friended these different kind of categories of pages, and that really is effectively people voting for the way they feel or how they want that experience represented for them. And this is what we found. Clearly, the pages with the most fans were these mockery pages. People not necessarily making light. I didn't interpret this as people making light of the riots. It's more like two fingers up to it, and to the rioters in particular, and saying, you know, you're not going to take us down. Right? It's more defiance, I think, than it is making light of anything. Riot reporters, another 100,000 there. Stopping the riot, 70. Riot cleanup, 40. And then trailing back towards the end were things that were launched in tribute to Mark Duggan. Again, just further evidence, a further sign that he really wasn't necessarily the thing that was motivating a lot of the activity. Eliminating geographic barriers. One of the things that was very interesting is I talked about the BBM messages and how they were sent out. What we saw a lot of people doing was actually taking those BBM messages, copying them, and throwing them up on Twitter, right, to get outside of the BlackBerry, to get outside of the BlackBerry network, to get out to other places. And many of the places that these came were in the U.S., and there's a really interesting, if you look at the volume of tweets that came from the U.S. there in white, and marry that against the volume of tweets related to the riot in the U.K., it takes much the same pattern, right? Clearly, these activities that were happening a whole ocean away were really interpreted and represented very much the same way in the U.S. as they were in the U.K. And that's true, too, if you look at just the news sources and people putting or established news organizations putting out these messages as well. The U.K. kind of path that it took in the volumes, very similar to the profile of the U.S. as well. And then how emotional expressions are in the eyes of the beholder. I talked about those six primary emotions, right? And so what we're able to do is we suck down all the different conversation and we scour it all for the emotions that are being expressed based on the words that are being used and the patterns of those words. And then we can just make a really simple word cloud out of which emotions were most relevant, right? And you would think, you know, sorrow would probably be a pretty prevalent emotion and certainly anger. This is what we found. A couple of things were somewhat surprising about this. First off, this is when you see something like this with so much negative emotion or so much one type of emotion, that means people are acting, right? They're singular in at least the root of their emotion. If not in their emotion, and this one actually has fear very clearly as a primary emotion, you at least are compelling a lot of activity because there isn't this other set that's fighting with a more positive kind of message. It's a pretty singular mind view. Now, the really interesting about this thing here is that that's in the U.S. That was the emotional response to the riots in the U.S. People looking at what was going on over there and being fearful for what could happen here at home, right? And you're an ocean away. I mean, there's no way that a UK rioter is making his way over to the U.S. to come smash stuff up, right? But yet that fear was the most prevalent emotion, the most important and the emotion that people here in the U.S. were feeling as they thought about and talked about the U.K. riots. This is what the U.K. looked like. And this is not surprising given the the events. There is a kind of somewhat substantial positive trend here with the hope and the love, but this is also coming at the tail end when the cleanup is happening and people are hopeful for recovery, and they love their city, and there's a lot of pride being emitted. Joy, you can't even see it. Joy is like this little speck, which makes sense. There was not a lot of joy for anyone in this whole experience. But sorrow was a very big emotion as well, as was anger. And then when you put the whole thing together, the U.S. and the U.K. together, and you look at those different emotions happening, one thing that we did see is that the intensity really happens together, which is really interesting for us. There wasn't a whole lot of differentiation, like fear happening here and anger happening here. It all kind of happened in lockstep. It was just in a relative size to one another. Now, it being used for good, too, the U.K. police launched this website, right, which had faces of different rioters. They had a couple of them actually as well. You know, the UK is one of the most surveilled countries in the world, and so they had so many photos of good facial photos of people engaged in the riots, and it wound up bringing a lot of people to justice. There were other people like this dude who went out and stole a bunch of stuff and then had his buddy take a picture of him and then tweet it, and he was arrested shortly thereafter. Other like hopeful pictures of this is just a twit pic that was put out of the cleanup effort, and so it was also used to kind of galvanize the city and bring people together. Now, what this has really created is that blueprint for the way you can use the power of social media to connect people and to install and instigate behaviors. So you have those elements in place, and there is some kind of spark that really triggers that activity, and the sort of power that's behind that is really extraordinary. And then one last thing I just wanted to do, which is a bit of a postscript, is look at after the riots and really look at the question of whether or not the UK riots spawned the Occupy movement. And I believe it did. I believe it had a great deal to do with it. I think that if the Occupy movement didn't necessarily learn how to operate as a result of London riots, I think they learned pretty well why you do these things. But there's still some things that can be, I think, questioned. Looking first, though, at global inequality, this is an estimate of the amount of wealth that would need to be redistributed in a country before everyone is on equal footing, right? The U.S. clocks in at 43%. 43% of the wealth in this country would need to be taken away, redistributed before everyone is on equal footing. And we're actually, while we're high, we're not among the worst five. I mean, those distinctions go to Honduras, Guatemala, Colombia, Bolivia, and then the Central African Republic. And you look at the countries that have the most equality in terms of wealth, probably not surprising. A lot of the old Eastern European communist countries, as well as our friends up in Sweden. Now, you take that profile of where there is equality and inequality, and then you overlay the sites of Occupy protests, and there's not necessarily a lot of correlation. There's something else going on. I mean, there are people staging Occupy protests in countries that have relatively good equality, and there are people in places that don't have equality that aren't daring to think of organizing an Occupy movement, right? There are other things that need to be in place, and a lot of that is the means and opportunity and motive that we talked about earlier. In all, there were 750 sites, and some of them, like the New York one, is running into trouble now. It's still going on. There's still a site open in London at the St. Paul's Cathedral. There was an enormous gathering in Madrid where you had fantastic pictures like this, 500,000 people gathering in the city for a couple nights. Just that power, that collective power of unification is really mind-boggling. And to come out with something like this, a 99% is a slogan and a meaning that has tremendous staying power. And it's tremendously emotive, and it led to campaigns like this where people would just take pictures of themselves with the signs of of the disadvantage and the hardships that they'd face, right, and how they fit into the 1%, or even better, don't fit within that top 1%. You know, people with medical bills, or people who had whose homes were underwater, who had already paid more to the bank than their home was worth, who owed tremendously obscene amounts of money to the bank still, only to have the banks repossess their homes, or people facing health difficulties and not having the means to pay for them, right? They are the 99%. Very emotive, very emotional, very compelling, really, stories coming out of that movement. To look at this kind of framework again, I think the London riots were the spark. I think there were low requirements. I mean, anyone could pick up, you know, write out their story and take a picture of it and send it out. Or even the kind of movements that were taking place had tremendous coordination to occupy New York and to occupy Oakland and other places. But you do need to ask the question, what really has Occupy achieved, right? Aside from that great slogan, what else has it done? Well, everything was there, and we talked about this, right? This is social network connections in the UK at 502 in the average person. The US, it's 516. We talked about income inequality, right? This was the estimate here in the UK, the amount of income going to the top 1%. The US is up here, right? I mean, we're unequal. You talk about policing. This is what the number of citizens to police force in the UK was. This is what it is in the U.S. This is the ability that that U.K. force has had in stifling crime. This is the ability that the U.S. has had. And this is where I think things start to go a little wrong. If you look at, those six primary emotions, and again, just for context, this is what the U.S. reaction to the London riots looked like. This is what it is. This is a profile for the Occupy movement. It's completely contradictory. You know, there's no single theme emerging from it. You've got positive messages also emerging with negative messages. And you have messages that are very powerful. And if you start to look at some of the more graphic illustrations of the movement and what people are really sticking in their head, you do have moments like this that do compel people and galvanize people. And you've got others like this where I doubt anyone in the Central Plains or someplace outside of this encampment feels like they qualify as the boredom. And yet that's what's represented as a 99%. And also looking at just who's representing and the pictures that are being used to represent the Occupy movement, I don't think it's really resonating with the 99%. And the message is eat the rich might be a little too dicey for someone outside of the Occupy stronghold. Fuck the police probably most likely is. And certainly fuck capitalism, I'm sure, really is. So you've got this movement, right, saying it's representing the 99%. And this is what the whole thing kind of comes to, is that owning that spark requires you to own and understand that perception, right? And unless Occupy can understand how people are perceiving them, their chances of landing that spark that's going to compel action is not possible. They are, I mean, for all intents and purposes, right, they are that trumpeter standing over eulogizing someone playing to a septic tank when they think that they're playing to a grave. And unless they get that figured out, it's not going to go anywhere. Summer's coming, though, and who knows? I mean, this could be a crazy summer. I don't know. Who knows what can happen? Because you do have a lot. There was a lot of mobilization, and these things are still very much in place. And so we'll just have to see what happens. But thank you very much. Appreciate all the time and the attention, and hope you enjoyed it. I think we ran right past questions, too, so you all can go get those margaritas now. Thank you. This is my Twitter handle. Again, if you want a copy of the presentation, just follow me. I'll make sure that everybody that does gets a copy of the presentation. Thank you very much.